ॐ भद्रं कर्णे तिष्णुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षिभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैश्चिश्वागुंसस्तनूभिः दिशेम ते रहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति न भूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Okay, we're on verse, for you it's 22, Vedaihi and Ekaihi Ahameva Vedyaha, is that right? Okay. Vedairanekairahameva Vedyaha, Vedairanekairahameva Vedyaha, Vedantakritveda Videva Chaham, Vedanta Kritse Devideva Chaham Napunya Pape Mamanasti Nashaha Napunya Pape Mamanasti Nashaha Najanma Dehindriya Buddhirasti Najanma Dehindriya Buddhirasti Nabhumirapo Mamavanyirasti Nabhumirapo Mamavanyirasti Yachani Lome Asin Asti na chambaram cha, na cha nilo me asti na chambaram cha. Vedaihi anekaihi aham eva vedyaha Vedanta pridveda videva cha aham. Vedavid eva cha Napunya pape mama na asti nashaha na janma deha indriya buddhihi asti na bhumihi apaha mama vannihi asti na cha anilaha me asti na cha ambaram cha. This is Vedaihi anekaihi ahameva vedyaha. I Vedaihi anekaihi ahameva vedyaha. I means the Paramatma, the self that I am in truth, the self which is Brahman, right? Aham I indeed am vedyaha, to be known, aneka, I'm the one to be known, myself as I am, I'm the one to be known, vedaihi anekaihi, by all of the Vedas. The Vedas, the Rig Yajusama Atharva Veda. It's the Upanishads, really the second part of the Vedas, right, that reveal the nature of the self. The first part of the Vedas are mostly just rituals and kind of a handbook, a manual for how to be in this world in the way that will give me maximum relative happiness. It's the last part of the Vedas, the Vedanta, Veda Anta, the end of the Vedas. The Upanishads are the Vedanta. Right, the Advaita Vedanta is actually the teaching methodology of the Upanishads. But really, the Upanishads are located at the end of the Vedas. Anta means end, so Veda Anta, right? Vedasya Antaha, that which is at the end of the Vedas. Also, sometimes Vedanta means that which is like the crest jewel of the Vedas. That's what all of the Vedas are leading to, is this knowledge of the nature of reality, which is knowledge, if we say Advaita, the non-dual. Knowledge of the nature of reality is the knowledge of yourself, because if there's one without a second, if Advaita means one without a second, and that is the nature of reality, then it has to be you, because there's only one, and you're here, and so am I, we're all here, so we're not non-existent. And so if the existent being that this creation enjoys is one without a second, then that existent being is you. you, which is me. That's the tetramasi, that thou art, means the existent being, which is Brahman. Which is, Brahman means infinite, that which is infinite, one without a second. So if the existent being, which is infinite, one without a second, is non-dual, then that existent being is the existent being, which we are. This we is really only one. It's like if you think of the ocean, the ocean has many, many waves. They have many countless waves, but really there's only one water there. So here, there's many, many forms, there's many jivas, there's many individuals. Each one says, well, I'm a wave, I'm a wave, I'm a wave. I'm my own separate wave. I'm my own separate individual. I'm my own separate conscious being. But actually, the conscious being that you are is one without a second. And this whole maya, this whole map, this creation, really is enjoying that one me. Now, that one me, I like to use the word me because when I think of myself, this self that I am, right? When we sit in contemplation and we're quieting down all of our, we're withdrawing really the sense organs and we're quieting down our body and we're settling down the unconscious and we're settling down the conscious mind and then just letting ourselves sit with that one, that presence, which is me. Right? I'm here all the time anyway, but when my mind is actively involved and engaged with the world, then I'm out here running around, so to speak. But when I quieten all of that down, then there's just me. Pure, simple, abiding, my pure, simple, abiding presence. That presence is Brahman. That's not the mind. It's not sense perception. It's not a vritti. It's the very content, the very self, the very being of the vritti means thought modifications, the very being, you know, which is immutable. Immutable is an interesting word. It means you can't, there's a lot of strength in that word, immutable. It means there's nothing you can do to you. To that level of your being, the conscious being that you are, there's no way you can't change it, you can't push it over, you can't get away from it, you can't cover it. There's nothing you can do. It is absolute stability. That part of you, which is your very self, which is your truth, in fact, it's that's the stable self. That self, you can't harm. You can't destroy. You can't make less. And you can't make more either. That's a relief. It's great to know that you can't hurt it or crack it or, you know, destroy it in any way or make it less in any way. But it's equally important to know that you don't have to improve it. Mm-hmm. Not even that you don't have to improve it. You can't improve it. You can't improve, you know, that which is non-dual, actually, that which doesn't have any parts. You can't make it any better. And so that self that you sit with at the time of, especially at the time of contemplation, not that it's not as present right now as it is when you're contemplating, it's just when you're contemplating, you're bringing all of that into all of that activity, all of the maya, all of the duality into a state of calm so that your being comes to the forefront. It's not that you aren't there. When the mind is active, you're absolutely there present. It's just that you don't have to perform so much discrimination between your own presence and the activities that you're engaged in. That's why we bother with contemplation. You know, just to shut everything down for the time being so only I am there. The only thing you can't shut down is you. And everything else you can withdraw from. You can easily shut down your sense organs, withdraw them so that you block out your perception of the world. You can do pranayama and various exercises like we did today in order to totally quieten the mind so that it's not thinking, there's no thoughts that are being generated. It's just absolutely quiet. So the thoughts you can stop, the images you can stop, you know, you can appease and quieten your emotions by giving them some love and some attention, you know, some giving them some comfort and care, you can, they'll settle down. So all of those things settle down and become not present for the time being, not present for the time being. But now try to do that. Let's see, let's shut down myself also. Let's withdraw from the one who's left. And the more you try to withdraw from the one who's left, the more that one alone is there. That one you can't sidestep. You can't get behind. You can't get in front of. You can't put a bag over yourself. There's absolutely nothing you can do. In fact, a good meditation, when you get to that point of having quietened down everything, is to then try to make yourself non-exist. Let's just imagine that I don't exist. Try to blot out everything. That's a very good meditation, because everything that can be erased will be. And what can't be erased will remain. And that's your own being. That being is Brahman. That being is infinite. It's Advaita. It's not dual. That being, which is my being, is your being. Not like my being. It is your being. The conscious being, the me, that sense of me, is that being. That sense of being, me, is the self of the whole creation. That me, if I get rid of the whole creation, the me experience remains as Brahman. That me experience, I am. That's who I am. The creation, whole creation disappears. The me, the I, is left. And that I think belongs to this body, and you think belongs to your body. You think that this sense of I belongs to your mind, and mine belongs to my mind, but no. I get rid of your body and my body, your mind, my mind, your sense organs, my sense organs, your eye thought, my eye thought. What remains is me. The me experience belongs to me. That is Brahman. That's the immutable self that never comes and never goes, never changes in any way. So the whole teaching of the Upanishad is you are that. You are that self, which is the self of all beings. You are that self, which is the very being from which the whole creation comes, is sustained, and resolves into. That's yourself. So here, the Upanishad says, I am that self that is revealed by all of the Vedas. Because all four Vedas have the same, what we call tatparya. They have the same vision. They have the same purpose, which is to unfold, in the end of the Vedas, to unfold that nature, the nature of yourself to you. The Upanishads are viewed as a teaching methodology to do just that. So he says, I am the one to be known by the several Vedas, all of the Vedas, and I am the Vedanta Krit. I am the one who teaches the Vedanta, who does the Vedanta. Vedanta is a teaching methodology, right? I'm the Vedanta Krit, I'm the Acharya, I'm the teacher, and I'm the student. I'm the Vedanta Vid. I'm both of the in this whole creation, right? All of the Vedas are revealing me. I am the one who's revealed by all of the Vedas. And I am both the teacher, the Vedanta Krit, the one who unfolds the Vedanta, and I am the one who receives it. I am the one who gains that knowledge also. So here, he's getting rid of the entire duality. So think of the meadow again. If you imagine the meadow, imagine the creation. You have the imagination of the creation of a meadow. And in your meadow imagination is the Vedanta Krit, your teacher, your acharya, your teacher. And sitting next to the teacher, in front of the teacher, is the Vedanta Vid, the one who gains this knowledge. Right? The teacher and the student are sitting there in the meadow. Right? That teacher is giving knowledge to the student of what? Of the nature of the self, which is the one from whom the entire meadow has come, and included in that meadow that has come from that Atma, from that limitless self, is the teacher and the student. So the Vedas themselves are looked at as beginningless, as coming along, that knowledge is coming along with the creation from beginningless time. The creation is viewed as cyclical, comes, sustains, resolves, comes, sustains, resolves. And within that creation come the Achara, the Guru, and the Shisha, okay? Teacher and student, you know, mother and child. It's all beginningless. It's all viewed as beginningless. And so who is the truth? Who is the self of the Vedanta Krit? of the teacher, the Atma, the self from whom the whole meadow has come. Who is the self of the Vedanta Vid, the one who receives the knowledge? The same Atma, the same self from which the whole thing has come. So he says, I am the one to be known through all of the Vedas. I am, to say like this, I am the teacher and I am the student. Means what? What's the truth of the teacher is the Atma, is the self. What is the truth of the student is the self. So the teacher teaches the student about the self, which is the truth of each one. And not only the truth of each one, the truth of the whole meadow, the truth of the whole creation. So he says, I am both the Vedanta Krit and the Vedanta Vid, Evacha Aham. First he says, I indeed am that one who is to be known by all of the Vedas. And then he says, Evacha Aham, and I am the Vedanta Krit and the Vedanta Vid. I'm the guru and I'm the Shisha. I'm the teacher and I'm the student. Then he says, he goes on. Now, that in my book, this is just, this one line is taken as its own little verse. And then it goes on to these next four, which is what is a meditative verse. He says, Nipunya pape mamana asti. He says, for me, there is no punya and papa. Punya and papa are the results of my karmas, the results of my actions. If I do an action which is an adharma of any kind, that will give me papa. Papa is a subtle result of my action that will cause negative experiences in my next life. Punya is the result of dharmic actions, of proper, of good actions, that will bring about positive experiences in my next life. And so for jiva, for an individual, you have, until you have knowledge, you take yourself to be a doer, right? An actor. And you're an actor of both, a doer of both good and bad actions. Those good and bad actions will have their effects here immediately. Like if you do, you know, I mean, if you hit somebody, then they're going to be bruised. That's the immediate result of that action. You know, if you trip somebody, they'll fall down. If you help somebody, they'll be happy with you, etc. There's an immediate result. An immediate result of any action that you do. But we say also that there is a subtle result. That subtle result we call punya and papa. Punya is positive, papa is negative. Those subtle results go into what we call the sanchitta. The sanchitta is the accumulated karmas that have yet, the results of which have yet to manifest. Right? There's what we call drishta karmas. Those results are called drishta pola. Those results are what happen immediately in this sphere. When I do an action, I reap the result on this plane. So that's drishta. Those are the seen results. But the subtle results have yet to manifest. So we call punya and papa. They go into what's called sanchitta. The sanchitta is the accumulation of my karmas that will manifest later. The sanchitta is what is the accumulation of karma from which the prarabdha karma comes. The prarabdha karma are those karmas that will cause my birth. Like this life that you have now is a manifestation of the prarabdha karmas that come from the sanchitta, from the accumulated karmas that have not yet rectified. And so this life from birth to death is a manifesting of the prarabdha karma, one major event after the other, after the other, after the other, that'll take you all the way through this life. And as you're going through this life, you're accumulating new karmas because you have the sense of yourself as a doer. I do this action, I'm the doer of this action, I'm doing doer of this action. So I'm accumulating these karmas. In the next life, again, the karmas from the sanchitta will start manifesting for my next life. That's what we call the prarabdha karma. And so now, for a person who doesn't have self-knowledge, This accrual of punya and papa is endless, as is the birth after birth after birth after birth after birth, which these karmas cause. So now he says, na punya pape mama na asti. For me, there is no punya and papa. For that silent being that I am, that simple, pure, conscious being which is me, there's no change. There's no becoming. There's no doership. The whole creation comes from that. The whole creation, the whole Maya manifests from that conscious being. But the conscious being that I am itself is not doing any becoming whatsoever. And so that self, yourself, is free from the transmigration, birth after birth after birth. It's never been born, it's never died, it never goes through any modification at all. It never collects punya, it never collects papa. It never reaps the results of your karma. From its standpoint, from the standpoint of just simple you, your own presence, you have no karma. You're not a doer. Right? You need a body, mind, sense organs, ahankara, ayanoshin, to be a doer. These all belong to Maya. The body, mind, sense organs, everything that exists within duality belongs to Maya. You, the only thing that doesn't belong to Maya, to this manifest creation, is you, your being. Your being doesn't come into existence and go out of existence. Your being doesn't become the creation and then resolve when the creation resolves. Your being is the stable one from whom this Maya manifests and goes into unmanifest condition. But you don't. Your self remains exactly the same. Reminds me of when my mother, who was so, when she was getting really, really old near the end of her life, one day she was telling me, I just can't believe I'm this old. I don't feel old. She said, I feel just the same as when I was young. I'm the same person. But now this body is so old. Yeah? And it was. It was really. And she said something like, it's so fun to be old, she said. Yeah. But, you know, if you think of yourself, the same, you're the same one. Your body has changed. Your mind has gone through, matured, and had so many experiences. You've had so many experiences. But the you, who you are, is the same. You go back to when you're a little girl or a little boy, you know, to when you're a teenager, to when you're 20s, 30s, you know. You are you. And then you take that me, actually, that me that you are, it is timeless. It's not growing old. Say you go back in terms of you're this body and you go back, you know, infinite number of lives, but say we just go back 500,000 lives ago. That's a long time. Go back 500,000 lives. Okay, we could go back a billion lives. It doesn't make any difference because it's beginningless. But this me that is here right now is the me, the self, that was present to those lives. Because no time. Time belongs to the creation, not to the self, not to consciousness. The conscious being that you are can't be objectified as an object to look at that's bound by time, that's existing within the creation. It's just like if you imagine a meadow and you have all kinds of characters in the meadows and, you know, animals and birds and people are walking along in the meadow, and say you hold that meadow imagination, you know, for 100 years or so, you know, in the meadow time. Everybody gets old, people are dying, you know. The animals are dying, new animals are being born, and you and your friends are all dropping off one by one after another. Okay, but nothing's happening to you. Nothing's happening to you. Right? And then you withdraw the whole meadow and still nothing happens to you. At all. Because yourself isn't an object bound by time. It doesn't exist within the meadow. It's the very being of the meadow. It's immanent to the meadow. It's immanent to the creation, but it transcends the creation also. You have a meadow imagination. Your being consciousness is immanent to the meadow and transcendent to the meadow. And before the meadow was there, you were there. During, while the meadow was there, you pervade it. When the meadow is gone, you're still there. Nothing has happened to you. It's the same in reference to the entire creation. I'm the self of this creation, and there before, during, and after. Nothing happens to me. I'm free from time. I'm free. I'm not bound by time. This you can even see continually in terms of your day-to-day experience. Once you make this viveka, once you make this discrimination between your being and all of the experiences on every level, on the level of your mind, on the level of your ahankar, your I thought, your moods, your emotions, your perceptions, these are all coming and going. Everything about your upadhi, body, mind, sense organs, moods, emotions, thoughts, I thoughts, they're all coming and going continually. It doesn't bother you at all. They go, they're gone. You're not gone, that's why it doesn't bother you. You're the truth of all of them, and you're changeless. Nothing happens to you. And so it's fine that these things all come and go. You don't feel any, like anything's really happening to you, and nothing is happening to you, right? Because your being is a sangha. It's free, it's immanent, but transcendent. Right? And so that has to be, you have to discern that in your own experience. So he says, I'm not free, for me there's no punya and papa. And he says, and nashahatna, for me, there's no destruction. There's no end. I can't be destroyed. There's no nasha. There's no destruction for me. Then he says, najanma deha indriya buddhi asti. For me, there is no janma. There's no birth. There is no body. There's no sense organs. There's no buddhi. There's no mind. There's no birth. There's no body. There's no sense organs. There's no mind. So think about it. Say, go back to the meadow. You imagine a meadow. You're a character in the meadow. Does yourself, the one from whom the imagination has come, have a body? The body belongs to the meadow imagination. Right? Not to you. Say you have that meadow imagination. You have it for 100 years and that body in the meadow dies. Does anything happen to you? No. Nothing. But that body's gone. You know another thing to notice? When you wake up from a dream, right, in the dream is so real. You know, it's so, say if it's a solid dream where you're really engaged in the dream. It's so real, it's real. And then something happens, alarm goes off or whatever, and you wake up from the dream. The dream is gone. The character you are identified, gone. Dream world, gone. But nothing has happened. It's not just that nothing has happened to you. It's true, nothing has happened to you. But, you know, nothing has happened. The whole dream world is gone, but nothing has happened. Because the truth of the dream world, right, is still there. What is actually there when you're dreaming is still there. And so there's no experience of anything happening because nothing does really happen. And it's just interesting to notice that because in this realm of reality, the waking, what we call the waking state versus the dream state, it's the same. I am as free in terms of this world as I am free in terms of my imagination as I am free in terms of the dream world. There is no, I'm a sangha. There, I'm immanent, but I'm transcendent. Nothing happens, and you can recognize this throughout this. It's a fact. You have to notice it throughout the day, that nothing is touching you in any way. No emotion, no, and most, the emotions are the most heavy, right? But it's a wonderful freedom to be able to discern the wholeness of your being in the presence of an emotion, let alone in the presence of a thought or in the presence of a perception, also in the presence of an emotion. You just notice, are you still there? Has anything happened to me, to my being? Just notice it. No. It's emotion. Emotion is there that I'd rather wasn't. But is it touching me? Is it touching my being? No, it's not. You have to notice that. we're so busy, our mind is so busy being engaged, you know, being in dialogue, being in relationship with all of these experiences that we're having, that I take myself to be those experiences. If I have an emotion, if I'm sorrowful, if I have a sorrowful emotion, I am that. If I have a happy emotion, I am that. If I have an agitated emotion, I am that. And I'm not that. That's what you have to notice. I'm not that at all. I'm always exactly the same. But that takes some viveka, right? It takes some discernment. And we'd rather not have these emotions that take us away like a, you know, ship in a storm, as Arjuna would say. You know, causes all of these emotions. That's another issue. You know, we have to come to terms with what causes the ajnana, the ignorance that causes that, those kind of, the self-ignorance that causes that terrible, you know, storm at sea. We have to see why that all happens. But in spite of all of that happening, there's a stable, changeless self inside. So that we have to recognize. So then he goes on to say, so I'm not my body, I'm not my indriyas, I'm not my buddhi, I'm not my sense organs, I'm not my buddhi, I'm not my intellect. You know, all of these things are not me. For me, there's no janma, there's no birth. Then he says, not only that, so now he's talked about you as an individual, you're not I, the self, and not any of these things. Then he says, Nabhumi apaha mama vanihi asti. For me, I am not the boom. I'm not the earth. I'm not the water. I'm not the fire. Nacha anilaha. I'm not the vayu. I'm not the air. And I'm not the space. Space, air, fire, water, earth. This whole creation that comes from me, sustained by me and resolves in me, I'm totally free of that also. I'm free of the jiva. I'm free of the body, mind, sense organs, and I'm free of the container that it's found in. I'm free of the meadow, and I'm free of everything in the meadow. Just imagine it. You say, you imagine a meadow. It's easy now in terms of the meadow to say, yeah, I'm not the meadow. The meadow comes from me. It's sustained. It resolves into me. I'm free of the meadow. I'm immanent to the meadow, and I transcend the meadow. But I am the individual in the meadow. Would you say it? Say you take a form. You take a form in the meadow. You imagine a meadow. And then you're a little person in the meadow along with the other friends walking to the meadow. Say, it's clear to me, myself is free, it's immanent to the meadow, right? The meadow enjoys my being, it enjoys my consciousness, right? So I'm the very, very being of the meadow, you know? But I'm free of the meadow. Then I can say, well, are you also free of the one who's in the meadow? The one you're identified in the meadow? No, I'm that person. No. You're neither the fire, air, the space, air, fire, water, earth, which projects as this creation, nor are you anything within it. The whole thing, everything that exists within time and space, the creation itself and everything that exists in it, you know, has me for its substratum, has me for its truth, but I'm not dependent on it. You can say, it's totally dependent on me. The meadow's dependent on me. This creation is totally dependent on me, but I'm not dependent on it. You can say the snake, you know, the rope snake, if a rope is mistaken as a snake, the rope can say, you know, that snake, it totally depends upon me. I'm four bends, it has four bends. I'm an inch in diameter, it's an inch in diameter. If I leave, it's gone. I can say, that snake, its entire being depends upon me. But you know what? I don't depend upon it in any way. In fact, the rope says, from my standpoint, there isn't even a snake there. I'm totally free. But the snake, it's not that way. Like that, the meadow comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me, totally dependent on me for its being. You know, I am its very self. But I'm not dependent on it. Its coming and going is totally irrelevant to my being. It doesn't touch me in any way. And so I say the same thing about this entire creation. It comes from me, is sustained by me, it resolves into me. It is totally dependent on me for its being. I am its being, but my being, the being that I am, is not dependent on it in any way. That's the relationship. That's satyam mitya. The satyam is the truth. The truth is, by truth we mean satyam, if we just translate satyam as true. The truth is, that which actually is. What actually is can't be negated. You know, it can't have non-existence on either side. So that which exists means can't be negated in past, present, and future. That is satyam. Mithya is that which itself comes into being and goes out of being, and so must depend upon being itself for its existence, because it has no being of its own. Otherwise, it couldn't have non-existence on either side. So the whole creation enjoys that dependent reality, what we call mithya. It depends upon the truth. It depends upon satyam for it to be. But satyam doesn't depend upon it. So like the rope snake, the snake totally depends for its being on the rope. It has no reality of its own. It has no independent reality. But the rope, on the other hand, doesn't need the snake at all. The rope is the satyam. The snake is mithya. So this creation, this body, this sense organs, the mind, all enjoy me. I am their self. I am their being. But I don't depend upon them. I am their being, but my being is independent of them. That's the satyam mithya relationship. So here he says, after negating being the jiva, the individual, so I'm not the creation either. I'm not the earth, I'm not the water, I'm not the fire, I'm not the air, and I'm not the space. Okay? So then he says, maybe one more line here. Evam viditva paramatma rupam. Evam viditva paramatma rupam. Guhashyam nishkalam advitiyam. Guhashyam nishkalam advitiyam. Samasta sakshin sarasad vihinam. Samasta sakshin sarasad vihinam. Prayati shuddham paramatma rupam. Prayati shuddham paramatma rupam. So he says, having known the paramatma, the self which is infinite, in this way, having recognized it, having realized it, evam viditva paramatma rupam, the self which is Brahman, the self which is infinite, which is non-dual, having realized it in this way, which is guhashriyam, that self which is abiding in the buddhi. And when we do meditation, we bring everything into that quiet space of the buddhi, and what is just left there shining all by itself is just my being, the Atma. So that which is abiding there in the buddhi, nishkalam, which has no parts, which is advitiyam, which is nishkalam, meaning it has no parts at all, it is advitiyam, it is non-dual, one without a second. Okay. Then he says, samasta sakshim, that self which is the witness of all. Samasta sakshim means the witness of all. It means that from the standpoint of your thought, any thought you have, that thought is known. What causes it to be known is the Atma, is consciousness. And so that consciousness is called a sakshi, a witness from the standpoint of the thought. So any thought and all thoughts that you have, right? Every thought that is known, it is known because of consciousness. So in the reference to the thought, it's called the sakshi, the witness. If you remove the thought, it's no longer a witness, because it's not performing any act of witnessing. It's only from the standpoint of the thought. If the thought is known, so we say, who is the knower of the thought? Right? Consciousness. But remove the thought, is pure consciousness doing any act of knowing? With what? What instrument does it have? It's only consciousness. So sakshi, the term witness, is a term that resolves into just consciousness itself. And so that paramatma, which is the witness of everything, sadasadvihinam, which is completely free of that which exists and that which is non-exist. In this creation, you have things that come into being and go out of being. The Atma is the self which illumines that coming and going, the coming into existence and going out of existence. I have a pot. The pot now exists. I break the pot, the shards exist. The pot's gone out of existence. So the sat and the asat. This creation that we experience is just a continual movement of from existence to non-existence, existence to non-existence, any moment of change is a movement from existence to non-existence or from non-existence to existence. Right? The coming into being is going from non-existence to existence. The going out of being is going from existence to non-existence. The Atma is free of this changing from existence to non-existence. It is the existence, the being that illumines this change. It is the being that illumines the birth, rebirth, the coming and going, the existence, non-existence, continual cycle of everything within the manifest creation. So the Atma, which is free of that, Sada Sad Vihina means free of that. The one who is known in this manner, Prayati, that one attains, reaches, goes to that Atma, that Paramatma, which is Shuddham, which is absolutely pure, which is the nature of the Paramatma Rupam, which is the nature of the limitless self. Prayati reaches not in terms of going, reaches in terms of knowledge. You already are that, you can't reach it, there's nowhere to go. But because you have taken yourself to be the body, now the Ahankara has to detach from that mistaken notion and attach itself, in a sense, to the Atma, to the self that you are. So in that way, the Ahankara reaches. It's a passage from Ajnanam, from ignorance to knowledge. And so here, having known in this manner, as has been taught through this whole Upanishad, having gained this knowledge, the knowledge of the Paramatma Rupam, having gained the knowledge, one reaches, it says here, this is a trick here, evam viditva, having gained it in this manner, gained what? The Paramatma Rupam, the self which is limitless, the self which is Brahman, so having known it, one reaches. What does one reach? The Paramatma Rupam. Mm-hmm. Having known it, one reaches it. Having known it, one gains it. And what is the nature of that Paramatma Rupam? Shuddham. Shuddham means advaitam, non-dual, doesn't have any parts. Right? So this actually ends, this verse ends the first part of the Upanishad. And now next week, there's two final verses. It's part two of the Upanishad, which is just two small verses that we have to do. So we'll do it. We'll finish it next week. Okay. Let's just take a minute. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
So if there is there's one without, there's only one basically, there's no other one.
Yeah.
So this whole concept of individual karma falls flat basically, right?
The individual karma, it's in the end it falls flat from the standpoint of the self. But relatively, you're here, I'm here, we have each as an individual have karma. Right, so as long as this jiva, from the standpoint of the jiva, there's karma. But from the standpoint of the self, there's no karma. But for the one who's ignorant, right, because you take yourself as an ajnani, ajnani means when he doesn't have knowledge, you take yourself to be this individual. And so within relative reality, the reality of this world, which has its own order, there is karma that causes you to take cause and effect, that causes you to take one birth after another, that in certain qualities and whatnot in each birth, you know, you're exhausting karma in each birth. But from an absolute level, the one inside, the one who you are in truth, is not suffering any karma at all. There is no karma from the standpoint of the Atma. But now if you were to say, okay, well in reality, you know, there's no karma, so why don't I just do what you want and what I want? You know, who cares? Well, you know, you can say, just like you can say, you know, nothing can harm me. And so, why don't I just stick my hand in fire? Because, who cares? Well, you will care. You will definitely care. So you don't want, as long as there's a body, mind, sense organs, you have to respect the Dharma. You have to respect Ishvara. Means Vishwa means the Lord. The whole manifestation of this creation with all of the laws of the creation need to be honored. That's why the whole first part of the, if you take the Vedas are like this thick. The first part is the Karmakanda. That tells all of the Dharma how to really be in this creation in a way that will give relative shanti. The last part is this. The Vedanta, the Upanishads. And what's the truth of the whole thing? Mm-hmm. Truth of the whole thing, you know, frees you from the karma, but it doesn't free the individual jiva from the results of karma. So even if you're in this life itself, you're a Mahatma. Jnananishtha, you never lose sight of your own being. But if you were to do a negative karma, which is hard to imagine happening actually for a Mahatma, because you don't need, for somebody who has nishtha, you don't have any need for something to make you do an adharma. But say you did. You did do an adharma. You would suffer the pain of that adharma. At the same time, recognizing the freedom of yourself, right? Which is not suffering. But your body, you would be, the mind would be suffering. The body would be suffering. Like another, maybe to make it more graphic, you're a Mahatma means that you really have clearly, without doubt, understood this knowledge and are abiding in it. The mind has antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, there's no problem. But if your body is injured, it will hurt. No matter how much knowledge you have, as long as this upadhi means this conditioning agent is here, you know, it needs to be protected and taken care of. Same with dharma, adharma. As long as the mind is here, it needs to be taken care of or you know, behave properly. Or it will suffer the results of those actions. You understand? Mm-hmm. But there's other layers of understanding around this too, and that is that as you gain knowledge, the inclination to do any kind of adharma drops off. The only reason you do an adharma in the first place is because I want this to be happy. I need this to be happy. I need this object to be happy. I need this situation to be happy. That's just the samsari belief. I need this. And I really need it badly, to the point that I'm willing to do improper actions to get it. I'm willing to sacrifice Dharma in one form or another to satisfy that desire, because it's so important to me. It's so important to me that I'll go against what I know is proper behavior. And so we do this in some little slips here and there in so many ways, and some people make bigger slips. You know, but the biggest slips, they're all about fulfilling my desire to be happy in the end. That's what it's all about. What if I don't have a desire to be happy because I'm already happy? If you're not happy, you have a desire to be happy. But say you, happy means whole, full. Say you already are. There's a beautiful verse in the Gita that says, you know, in India, they always will build their wells in the middle of rivers, because in the summer, you know, the river will dry up, but that's the place where the most water will seep down into the ground. So they'll build the well right in the middle of the river. So now in the winter, when it's time to, you know, go get some water, they don't trudge right into the middle of the river to find the well, right? Because the water is already there, right? So like that, for a person who's already full and complete, they don't need to go into the middle of the river to find the well, because the waters are already flowing, you know? So a person who recognizes that the source of the ananda that you seek is the Atma, is the self, once that mind recognizes that, that this circuitous route that we always take to become happy, all that's really happening is that when I say like, I want that object, I want that, and so I'm tense and trying to get it and trying to manipulate everything so that I can fulfill that desire. When I finally fulfill the desire, at that moment, my mind's quiet. I'm desireless at that moment. And in that quiet mind, just like the sun reflects off of a very still water, as though the sun totally penetrates into the still water, when my mind is quiet, the Atma reflects, myself reflects in that mind in such a way as to, for the mind to enjoy ananda, bliss, happiness. And then the mind says, oh, I love that object, it makes me so happy. But the happiness has nothing at all to do with the object. The object is totally irrelevant in reality. It's relevant for the samsari because I do this circuitous route. I go after the object, whatever object it may be. When I get the object, if I do, the mind relaxes. Like the sun, the self manifests in that mind, and then the mind feels happy. I'm so happy now. For a jnani, one who has knowledge, they don't go out to the object. They just relax and let the mind, let the self, you know, reflect in that mind. And not only that, the self itself you recognize, like when we do just in today, if your mind became quiet and when you're doing that meditation and you notice who you are, the nature of your being, it isn't jumping for joy ananda. It's deeper than that. Your own being is deeper than this happiness. It's not just happy, it's absolutely whole, it's everything. You are the greatest ananda. And then that reflects in a quiet mind in a way where the mind enjoys different moods, different states of happiness and joy. So for the jnani, we don't ask, oh, you be this way so I can be happy, or let me have that thing so I can be happy, or, you know, let me do this so I can be happy, or let these people treat me like this so I can be happy. All of this samsara drops off. Just drops off. And as it drops off, there's no reason to do a dharma. The human heart is basically very good. It's very pure. It's Brahman. You know, there's no... for who you are, there's no inclination to do a dharma. That all comes about through ignorance. So through having, projecting my happiness onto an object and then running after it. And then all kinds of things create confusion and problems. Just think about it. As soon as you have a desire, the whole world divides up. The desires are very threatening. They're very uncomfortable also. Whenever one rises in his head, it's very, very uncomfortable because now you have to get that thing. And there's all these reasons that things, people, situations that could stop you from getting it, and just all kinds of worries, a mess. I think when you don't have a desire, at that time you just kind of appreciate Ishwara, you appreciate the creation, you're happy, all is well. All is well with you until the desire arises. And then there's tension and stress. And for a jnani, you know, there's no problem because myself is always the same. And your mind can never be away from yourself. So it's the solution to the problem. And that's what it is. It's the solution. You don't have to maintain yourself. It's the only thing that doesn't have to be maintained. Everything else has to be handled, managed, maintained. Because by its very nature, it's changing. There's nothing in the creation that's not changing. Nothing about the jiva, the body, the mind, the sense organs, it's all in continual change, all the time. And then everybody you know, every situation you're in, it's all subject to change. And so to get everything to line up just right is really stressful. You know, get all your ducks in order so that you can have a moment of happiness. You know, and then somebody in the mix does something to throw it out of balance again. Sometimes you do. You're the one that does. If you have a self, if you have yourself, then you can enjoy the creation as it is. That's the beauty. You can enjoy the situation. You can enjoy the people. You can enjoy your prarabdha. You can enjoy the events of your life because you're not threatened. You know that they have to be this way or that way so that you can be happy. If you don't have to wring happiness out of them, you know, then you can actually be with them. You can be with your situation. You can be with people. Really be with them, you know. With them as they are, who they are, and enjoy them as they are. It's hard to do that when you have to have them be a certain way so you can be happy. It's a big pressure on everybody. Hey, Ben.